Good evening, everyone. I am Linda, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Linda.
This has been a wonderful week, and this was a wonderful dinner, and you guys are wonderful. You look great. And at this point, I'm going to ask my speaker, Deb D., to take a seat. And it's my privilege to introduce her. But first, I'd like to let you know that I'm also honored and privileged to serve Area 49 as this current delegate. It's been a wonderful, wonderful journey so far. Who is Deb D? She's my guest speaker tonight. Deb and your wife. Deb is a past delegate from panel 60 past delegate from Area 48, and that's HMB. And those of you who don't know what HMB stands for, it's Hudson Mohawk Berkshire. But wait, they lost the Berkshires. Where are they? We'll have to let Deb tell you about that, okay? But it's HMB. Her home group is the Keep It Real group in Bloomington, New York. Currently, she is the literature chair at her home group. She is also the program chair for the New York State Informational Workshop that's coming up this year, 2014. So all you committee chairs that were getting my emails, this is the young lady that asked for those topics. So if you didn't get them to me, you can get them to her before she leaves. How did I meet Deb? It's a story. I first met Deb at a New York State workshop, and she was then the current delegate of Area 48. And I remember after some of the questions and panels spoke, they asked a lot of questions, and Deb had already come back from her first conference, I believe it was. And I remember she was running over to the table, opening the book, looking for the answers, and came back with those answers. And I was an alternate delegate then. Susan was our delegate. And we were both, and I was watching her. I was like, well, I wonder if I ever became delegate, would I be able to know how to find the answers? Because she was finding them, you know? And then, in my last year as alternate delegate, I was with Susan. We were either at a NARASA or NERD event, and I saw them giving out these little beautiful pins that I'm buttons or little people that I'm wearing. And I wanted one so badly, and I was like, gee, Deb is rotating out. How am I going to get one of those buttons? Because I really liked Susan. She had a clothespin one with little eyes and things. And then, of course, the year that I rotated in as delegate, our current delegates, we summoned them back to make our first button, which is this little guy right here. So afterward, if you can't see it, you will see it. It's got little eyes. So I managed to get my button. And then this past year was like, what are we going to do? Who's going to make the button? And these are NERD buttons, N-E-R-D. You know what NERD stands for? Northeast Regional Delegates. And we call ourselves NERDs, and Deb's a nerd. So this year, an email came out, and they said, would anyone like to take up the challenge of making the NERD button? Or should we call Deb and ask Deb to do it? And of course, everybody said, call Deb. It would be okay. And so now I have my second NERD button, which has the big book on it, and it was made by none other than Deb. So thank you, Deb, for all your work. She is very, very creative. Yeah, I don't know how she did them, but I love them. I love them. So that's how I got this. And that's my story of how I met Deb. Now, I know she's getting nervous, but it's about time I brought her to the mic. Deb, welcome Deb, please, with a round of applause. About
Thank you. Thank you, Linda. Hi, everybody. My name is Deb, and I am an alcoholic. And there are a lot of people in this room. Wow. It was an honor and a privilege to serve as the Northeast Regional Delegate for Area 48 and to represent Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is a wonderful thing when you serve at conference to have 17 other delegates that you're with who you can rely on and lean on. It's an amazing thing. And anybody who's interested in doing that, you know, talk with your past delegates, your current delegate. It is an amazing experience. But I do have to say that all service positions in Alcoholics Anonymous are rotatable, and including making nerd buttons, I will not be making it next year because I have rotated that position. So a little bit of humor there. First of all, I would like to thank Linda for asking me to share this evening, and I would like to extend my thanks to all of you for being here at this convention, because without all of you, we wouldn't have had the event. And the program chair, everybody has been phenomenal in terms of hosting me here, but I just got an amazing gift from all of you guys this weekend. First of all, the sobriety countdown always chokes me up. To see a room of people get excited about their sobriety, about how long they've been here, the fact that you guys go through your challenges, and you're still hooting and hollering about your sobriety date, it just really chokes me up. And the thing that I saw happen this weekend is what I have experienced in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, is the love of the fellowship. I sat in the back of the room last night, and I watched, it happened to be two women sitting in front of me, and I swear every woman that walked in the room last night first stopped and spoke to those people, gave each other hugs, and then they all went and sat down. And I finally said something to the women, like, there's something going on here because I see the love. And both those women turned around and gave me a hug and a kiss. And it's just an amazing thing to feel a part of. You know, many of you I don't know, but after this weekend, I feel like I have about 900 new friends. And so, you know, I may not know you personally, but I've seen a lot of your faces, a number of you have shared, and you all have touched me in a very special way. I was really touched by Joan last night, our Al-Anon speaker. She shared her story about her journey in Al-Anon and her husband in AA. And when I heard Joan speak last night, I thought about my parents. And part of their journey was that my father was the alcoholic, and my mom, when he got sober, she went into Al-Anon. The love that I got to see with my parents it blossomed after they went into their 12-step recovery. And it was exactly what Joan shared about last night. You know, and to hear the gift from Steve about talking about his travels and the translation of some of our literature. When I was an area chairperson and a delegate, I used to go and visit all of our districts. And when you're in certain service positions, you try to get creative about how you share the message and how you can touch people. And when one of the things that I used to do is I used to bring translated big books with me. And during that process, I would talk about the seventh tradition, and I would let people know about, you know, when you put your money in the basket, you know, you first take care of your home group, and you make sure that you have your literature and your coffee and your doors are open and the rent is paid. And when that is done, then you pass the monies on beyond your prudent reserve to the rest of the AA entities. And I would talk about that, and I would share about those translated big books, and I got to love those translated big books. And in every translated big book, whether you can speak the language or not, you can, in those big books, find the fourth step inventory and how it works. So I challenge you all to go look at that. And to me, that's the language of the heart. You'll notice it by how those big books are formatted. And two of those occasions, the first one when I was raffling off a Mongolian big book, the person in the room that night at that district meeting that won that big book happened to be in a halfway house, and his roommate was from Mongolia. And in another one of those district meetings, I raffled off a simplified Chinese version of that big book. And the person who won it that night happened to be traveling the next day to China and was looking for that big book. And so, you know, we get creative when we come to learn our little things within the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And those are just a few of the things that have touched my heart and my little spiritual experiences that I like to share. So now that I've kind of gotten a little acclimated to being in front of all of you, I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Keep It Real group in Bloomington, New York. We meet on Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m. We're an open discussion meeting, and the reason I joined that home group is because in the beginning of their meeting, they talk about the preamble, and they say that you are a member of this group if you say you are. And I love that because it reminds me about when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. My current service position, as Linda indicated, is that I am the literature chair for my home group, and I am a past delegate. But, you know, a couple years ago when I rotated as delegate, I was kind of like, well, you know, I've done a lot of this service. I've been in the service structure for a long time, and what am I going to do? And I felt a little misplaced because we don't talk about what's next after you've been a delegate. And I went to my home group, and the service position was available. And I love the fact that God works in my life because with that service position, I get to package up the beginner's packets for our meeting, and when somebody walks in the room and say, hi, I'm an alcoholic and this is my first meeting or I only have a few days, I get to go to that person, I get to talk with them, and I get to share our literature and a meeting list, and I get them connected with Alcoholics Anonymous. And if it's a female, I'll talk with them for quite a while, and if it's a male person, I'll connect them with the men in the meeting. And I qualify, when I speak, those things because it helps me to remind myself that Alcoholics Anonymous is the most important thing in my life. Without Alcoholics Anonymous, I probably wouldn't be standing in front of you. In fact, I know I would not be standing in front of you. And not just because this is a room of alcoholics and we're all trying to stay sober, but I wouldn't be thinking about any of you. I'd be thinking about me and where I'm going to get my next drink and how is it going to, how am I going to manipulate all those things? I grew up in an alcoholic home. My father was the alcoholic. I'm one of six children. I have a twin sister. I mention that because growing up as a twin was fun, challenging at times. But I didn't have my own identity. I didn't know who I was. We were always the twins. And in my household, we were raised German Catholic. We went to church. We had, when my grandfather came from Germany, he bought a piece of property, this apple orchard. And when each one of my father's siblings got married, they got a piece of the property, and we all lived next door to each other. We had, 25 cousins growing up together. And what was happening for me was that everything was looked good on the outside. It's like that nice little white picket fence. We didn't have one, but it was that kind of scenario. And but on the inside, it wasn't quite like that. My father was the type of person who would get angry, and 5 minutes later, he would be fine. And as a little girl, I didn't know how to deal with that. We grew up not communicating. We didn't sit at the table and talk about how's your day. We didn't talk about, you have a problem with something going on at school. Here's how you might want to solve that. There was none of that. So you learned how to deal with things on your own, and those were my survival mechanisms. And it was like that for a long time. I did not start drinking until, I guess I was a late bloomer. I didn't start until I was out of the house and in college. But before I get there, my dad went into rehab the day before my senior year of high school. And I talk about that because that's how I remembered his sobriety date. He remembered his sobriety date as the day after Labor Day. And, I talk about that because it's about perspective. It's about how we see things, our interpretation of things. My twin sister and I, when we were born, we were the last of the litter, so to speak. We're the last kids. to be born, and we weren't a planned pregnancy. My mother didn't know she was having twins. And I took those pieces of information and said, I wasn't wanted. I wasn't worthy. There's not enough love in the family. And that directed my thinking for a very long time. So, you know, here's my dad. He's all of a sudden deciding that he has a problem with alcohol. And he goes off to rehab. He's gone for 28 days. During that time frame, mom leaves and she goes to a family program. And my family was not wealthy. You know, had we been able to afford it, she probably would have brought myself and the kids that were still at home. But we weren't in a financial position to do that. And so I just went to school and tried to figure out how to cope with what was going on. My dad comes home from rehab, and all of a sudden, all the alcohol is out of the house. You know, this is a gentleman who used to hide his alcohol in the garage in the fertilizer bag. And, you know, our response was just leave it there, you know, don't disrupt the family. And all as I wanted at that point in time, because everything that I had learned to cope with was kind of now thrown out the window, because now here's dad staying sober. He's going to meetings. Mom's going to Al-Anon. And I was an angry ACOA, adult child of an alcoholic, you know. I didn't know how angry I was until I got in the program. But we'll get there. So I graduate in my high school class. My high school class is all of 82 people. This room feels more like college. Where I went to college, there was 10,000 people, you know. And my first day, at this point, I still had not picked up a drink. The rules of the house, and back then you just didn't break the rules of the house, was you don't drink until you're drinking age. And I didn't think twice about it. So up until that point, I hadn't picked up a drink. I go to college, my first night at school. I'm in about an 8x10 room with two other girls. They're out drinking. One comes home vomiting because they had drank too much, and the other one's totally passed out. Welcome to college. And so one of my little character defects that kicked right in, which is perpetual motion. If I keep moving and I keep doing, I don't have to think. And that's what I did for my first year of college. I didn't do my normal, you know, the normal five classes. I did six classes. Because if I was busier, then I didn't have to think about what was going on. I didn't have to think about the fear of being around people, the fear of being on a campus of 10,000 people. I didn't have to talk with you. I could just keep moving and be a fly on the wall. And about my sophomore year of college, I don't know what happened. Some people might call it peer pressure. Some might say it's just the propensity that, you know, I had that gene of alcoholism in me, but I picked up my first drink. And so it took me 6 years in this program to remember that first drink. It's the one and only time I ever had one drink. And I always describe it in my story as like being on the side of the pool and dipping your foot in and see if it's warm, see if it's okay. And for the first time, I felt like I was part of. I had that warmth that people talk about when they take the drink. I definitely was part of the crowd. I was the in crowd now because I was now drinking with everybody. And I sought that time and time again. Now I remember my first drunk as if it was yesterday. And I don't know how that works, how it can take me so long to remember that one drink, but yet I can talk to you about getting drunk as if it happened yesterday. I never forgot that. Well, let me rephrase that. I remember it up until the point I blacked out. That night, I had those drinks probably six deep, rum and coke, Captain Morgan's. I loved Captain Morgan's. That first bottle came from a basketball coach, so there was other issues going on. It is kind of funny now that I say it. I wish I still had the picture. I was like, yeah, having a great time. But at some point, I blacked out. And this was going to be the pattern of my drinking until the day that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. which was, I never knew at what point I was going to black out. It might have been one drink, it might have been 10 drinks, but at some point in that journey, whenever I picked up a drink on any given night, any given day, I was going to black out. And my journey through my drinking was that I controlled it, I didn't control it. In college, you know, there's this big thing about Thursday night, so it started there, and then Thursday became Thursday and Friday, and then it became the whole weekend. And then I started noticing that it was getting in the way, and so then I would try and cut back a little bit. And in a four-year period, I did a lot of the things that people talk about in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I woke up in strange places. I woke up with people that I didn't know. I almost got thrown out of school because I got caught drinking in the dorms. During my drinking, I now, after many years, remember, you know, being in an accident after I had been drinking. And that time that I was in that accident, you know, it was a God thing, I guess. I rear-ended this woman. She comes running out of the car. I thought I was going to get yelled at. She says, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm okay." She says, "Great, I'm leaving." I'm like, "What do you mean you're leaving? I just rear-ended you." And, well, she didn't have a registered vehicle. So, you know, God somehow was working in my life there. I didn't get thrown out of school because I had an exceptional do-gooder in my life at that time, which was the Dean of Student Affairs, who I worked for. And so he made my problems go away. And, you know, during that whole process, what ended up happening for me was that I became spiritually bankrupt. The last part of my drinking, I was out of school. I was working for a company. At the time, I was traveling about 2 weeks out of every month. And my drinking was when I was traveling because I could pad the expense account. Nobody would see it. I could take taxis and not deal with the repercussions of drinking and driving. And at the end, even the people that I was working with began to see the effects of my alcoholism. So at that time, I went to the employee assistance program at work, and I asked for help. And no matter, I don't even know what I said at this point to them, but they directed me to a 12-step recovery program. It was not Alcoholics Anonymous. I was one of those people that came in through Al-Anon, and I am so grateful for Al-Anon. You know, I am not one of these speakers who will bash Al-Anon, never, ever, because Al-Anon saved my life. And what happened for me in the meetings that I went to for Al-Anon, and I don't know if they ever said this, but this is what I heard. Aside from go to 6 meetings and check it out, which I think is funny because a lot of times you hear 90 and 90 in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like, okay, that's a little different, but what I heard was, if you're going to deal with your family's problems with alcoholism, maybe you should stop drinking. I don't know if I heard it. I thought I heard it. And so in the rooms that I was going to Al-Anon in, there were members of Alcoholics Anonymous in those meetings. And one day, I was in a conversation with somebody, and I said, you know, I am trying not to drink so that I can deal with these problems with my family, and I can't stop drinking. And they suggested that I go to an open AA meeting. And the tears here are that the person that brought me to my first meeting ended up having eventually 10 years of sobriety. And that person has been in and out of the rooms and doesn't even have a year today. And so, you know, this program is such a lethal, you know, our disease is such a lethal thing. And there are days when I wonder, you know, why me? Why do I stay here? You know, what keeps me here? And why can't that person stay sober? I was having a conversation with my sponsor this weekend, and the sponsor that I have today is my third sponsor. And my first two sponsors have gone out. And both are back in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but they went out after significant time. And so I question, you know, what keeps me here? And one of the things that people talked about during this weekend was being in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not about just showing up at meetings. It's about having a home group, about participating in that home group, and doing other service that keeps us in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a choice that I've made today. So, you know, my first year of recovery, so I'm not even sure if I said my sobriety date. My sobriety date is November 1st, 1990. And thank you. And when I came in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you told me that I would be standing here 23 plus years later in front of all of you, I would have said you're crazy. Because my experience with coming in the rooms was that I would come into the meeting about 30 seconds before it started. And I'd sit in the back of the room. And I wouldn't say anything. Probably the first 6 months to a year, I cried a lot in my meetings. And then as soon as the meeting was closed, with whatever prayer it was, I was out the door. And what was happening for me was I would have that, maybe we'd call it serenity, I'd have some peace of mind for maybe about an hour during the day when I was sitting in the rooms and listening to the meeting and listening to other people. And then for the rest of the time during the day, for the other 23 hours, I was white-knuckling it. And I was not having a good time. I was miserable. And somewhere along the way, my mind opened up. I heard something. And people talked about get a home group, get a sponsor, and start working the steps. And so I got a home group, and I found a sponsor. And I started working the steps, starting to have a relationship with a sponsor. It wasn't easy because I didn't trust anybody. And the fact that I was trying to trust a female was even harder because I didn't trust females. And things started to happen. I was now in the rooms. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. Somewhere along the way during a business meeting, my hand went up. Yeah, I got the coffee position. And I couldn't figure out why I was making coffee for all of you, because I did not drink coffee. And I was still thinking about me and not about you. And when I had to give up that coffee position, that was about the time when I realized what had happened. I had to get to the meeting early. Even though I didn't like talking with you, I ended up talking with you, because what are you going to do when you're there early and all of a sudden people are coming in and they want to tell you how good your coffee is? Now, whether the coffee was good or not, I don't know, but they told me it was good. And I started to get some phone numbers, and I started to reach out, and I started using the phone. And, you know, those are the little things that happened when I started in a home group. Back then, I took a little bit of time off from traveling with work because I was afraid to go traveling. That was where my drinking had taken me. You know, that was what I was doing when I came in. And so all of a sudden, I had to go on a business trip, and I didn't know what to do. You know, back then, we didn't have the internet like we have today. We did not have online meeting lists. And so, you know, I talked with my sponsor, and she said, why don't you bring it up as a topic in a meeting? So I'd raise my hand, and I'd say, what do I do? I'm traveling. I need some suggestions. And the people were great. You know, they said, call ahead, call the intergroup, know where your meetings are going to be, you know, put a schedule in place, call the hotel room or the hotel. Make sure your room does not have a mini bar. And if your room has a mini bar, ask them to take the alcohol out of the mini bar. Seemed pretty logical. So, you know, the week of my 90 days, I have to travel, so I did all the stuff that they told me to do. Knew where my meetings were. I was at a meeting on my 90 days. I had to argue with the hotel to take the alcohol out, but I did that. And I was staying sober. And then this was the first realization that I had problems other than alcohol, because I met him. (Laughter) And so instead of me leaving when I was supposed to leave and come home, I stayed the weekend. And I didn't pick up a drink, but I learned that, you know, in my early recovery, that being in a relationship was not necessarily the smartest thing. And we hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous a lot, don't get in a relationship in your first year. Well, you're going to tell me not to do something? I'm going to do it. And so I don't tell my sponsees, don't get in a relationship in your first year. I tell them about what my first year was like. And I refer to the literature in Living Sober where it talks about emotional entanglements and how emotional entanglements, whether it's a relationship or something else that's going on, can get in the way of putting Alcoholics Anonymous in your recovery first. My first year was not pretty, and I'm not going to go into all the details here, but suffice it to say that it went something like this. Met him at 90 days, was engaged by 60 days, or 6 months. By 9 months, I was pregnant. After that, the pregnancy did not go to full term. I realized that he was one of us, and I ran. You know, I ended the relationship and I ran away from that. And at any point during that first year, I could have picked up. There were so many times that my life was just absolutely insane my first year. And I don't know how people in my home group put up with me. I don't know how my sponsor put up with me because I wasn't taking suggestions. And somehow I stayed sober. But it could have been easier, it could have been a softer way. And I talk about that with my sponsees. Somewhere after that time frame, I met another him. There's a few of them. So I grew up as a little girl thinking that I should get married, should have a family, should have the house, should have a dog. I had the house, he had the dog and the kids, and we got married. And it was supposed to be happily ever after. And during that time frame, I lost sight of the fact that I was an alcoholic and should be going to meetings. And after we had gotten married, he knew I was an alcoholic. He respected not having alcohol in the house for a while. He knew what my triggers were in terms of alcohol. So he respected that. But over time, I stopped going to meetings. And the conversation between my ears was not good. And eventually, he started bringing beer in the house. And our relationship went downhill. And there's other circumstances that had happened as well. And, you know, I was down in Florida. I had this, you know, I came to believe that when you get married, you're married for life, you know, till death do you part. And so, you know, things were not good. They were rocky. And I'm down in Florida thinking, okay, this one last trip, we'll give it a shake, see if it's going to change anything. And the second time he said he didn't want me there, I left, and I came home. And what happened was I got in my car, and my car went to a meeting. I don't know how it happened. I think I know how it happened. There were a few people, my friend Mary Ann, who stayed in contact with me, and she would always ask me if I wanted to go to a meeting. And I'd always say, no, I've got something to do and all this stuff. But she always would ask me to go to a meeting. This meeting that my car went to had changed meeting locations, had changed the time, and somehow I got to that meeting. And when I walked in the rooms, I saw a few familiar faces and a lot of the same messages that I heard when I first came in, which were, get a home group, get a sponsor, start working the steps. And at that point, I realized that even though I had not picked up a drink since November 1st, 1990, and I don't know what time frame that had been. It was a couple of years. It's probably a year I didn't go to a meeting. But at that point, I knew I wasn't working the program. I knew I wasn't giving it an honest shake. And at that point, I also realized that if I was not committed to having a home group and showing up and having a service position by name, whether it was picking up ashtrays, sweeping the floors, stacking the chairs, whatever it was, if I didn't have a name to my service position, then I was not going to be going to a meeting. And so in my head, I knew that if I had that position, I would go to a meeting. And that's what had happened for me. That's still the connection that I have in my life, that if I have a service position, I'm going to show up and I'm going to have some integrity in my program. In the journey of going through a divorce and everything, I had been working the steps, and I thought I had the, how do I want to say it? I was doing the steps. I thought I was doing good. I was the person that you hear sometimes in the rooms who, you're doing the fourth step and you ride around with it underneath the seat of your car. Because I didn't want my ex-husband, we weren't ex yet, but I didn't want him to find my fourth step. And I had done my fifth step. I didn't have that big woohoo spiritual awakening. I think I felt worse after my fifth step than before. My miracle steps were actually 6 and 7. But as I was going through the divorce, I had found out that my husband, ex-husband, had found my fourth step. And that came up in the divorce. And I was so grateful at that point to have some loving people in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, because my sponsor worked with me, and the people that knew me reminded me that that person that I wrote about in that fourth step was not the person that was there at that moment. That was somebody in the past, that there was some things that I had to clean up, and that I was a changed person at that point. I also learned that it's really good to do your fourth step the way it's outlined in the big book, because I had done mine as a biography, autobiography. And let me tell you, there were some details in here that I wouldn't want anybody in this room to read. And the reason why you do it as an outline in the big book is so that you don't have all the details. It's a conversation you're going to have with your sponsor or whoever your trusted person is when you do your fifth step. But you get enough on paper so that you can have those conversations. And I'm going to jump around a little bit. During I forget exactly when, but my dad was in recovery. He died with 19 and a half years of sobriety. And in the last 10 years of his life, he went through some horrific surgeries and had some challenges. And the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous was that I was able to show up at certain times as a daughter, other times as a trusted friend in Alcoholics Anonymous, and every once in a while, the person that needed to give him a good kick in the rear end. And, through that whole time, we were able to make amends to each other. It wasn't about, all the things that he had done wrong. I did not like my father when I came in the rooms. I was angry at my parents because everything that was going on in my life was all their fault. That got sorted out when I did my fourth and fifth step. And I was able to take responsibility for my life. And, the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous was, the day that he died, I was by his side. And there was nothing left unsaid. I was able to spend some beautiful moments with him, probably at the worst times of his life. And they were tremendous gifts from my higher power. I when I left home, I vowed I was never going to live with my parents again. And I didn't live with my dad because he passed. But today I have my mom who lives with us. 5 years after my dad died, she got tired of living in the house that she raised 6 kids in. And she asked if she could come live with my husband and I. And we offered, we opened up our home to her. And I think the only reason why it works in our house is because she still goes to Al-Anon and we go to AA. You know, that's how it works. When I came in the rooms, and I'm going to backtrack for a moment, when I came in the rooms, I got to the point, the jumping off point that you hear about in the Big Book. And for me, the choices were either to do something with my drinking or to commit suicide. And had I had my choice, I would have picked suicide. But there was something that happened for me, and it was my moment of clarity. And my twin sister had attempted suicide about a year or so prior to me coming in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was the first one to see her, and it tore me up. It tore our family apart. And she's with us today, thank God. And in that moment of clarity, I would not put my family through what she put us through. And what happened was I came into the rooms. And I was celebrating my 20-year anniversary, and my sister and I we're just two peas in a pod. I love her to death. And we're having a conversation around that time frame, and I was able to talk with her about what happened to me and how I got in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was able to thank her for attempting suicide because she was the one that got me into these rooms. Had she not done that, I probably would not be standing here. And that's one of the gifts of the program, to be able to come full circle and have gratitude for the experiences that I've had and to be able to thank the people that have allowed me to be a part of their life. I want to share before I end up having to get kicked off the stage here about what's happened for me in the last couple of years. So I talked about the fact that I served as a delegate, and it was a phenomenal experience. And, you know, I rotated out, and on January 4th, 2012, I was a past delegate. And I woke up that morning, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I wasn't happy. I wasn't happy because I was 60 pounds heavier than I am today. I had been doing a lot with Alcoholics Anonymous and putting AA first. And when I say I was putting AA first, it was like everything that I was doing was AA. I mean, I was still going to a job. I was still doing all of that. But somewhere in my journey of service, I lost balance in my life. And so I had gained weight, I had not been exercising, I had been not eating correctly. There was a lot of things that were going on. And I started the journey of trying to get some balance back in my life. And through that, I was able to lose some weight. I was able to experience the fact that I absolutely love to run and find some things that really give me joy in my life other than Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I've been able to bring some of the things that I've learned here into, you know, some of the things that I'm doing outside of AA. But one of the challenges that I've had is practicing these principles in all of our affairs, all my affairs. I still struggle with practicing the principles in my family life, in my work life. And my sponsor, God bless him, because he has just been so kind and gentle with me on getting through how to deal with certain situations. And I'm going to digress for a second. And I want to talk about my sponsor for a moment. It was back in 2006. We had a convention, much like this. And had some wonderful speakers, of which my sponsor was one of them. And at that time, I had a recovery sponsor, but she was moving to California. We were also in the middle of some stuff going on in our area, and I needed a service sponsor, and by golly, I was not going to have a service sponsor in my own area because I needed some outside viewpoints about some of the service structure and some of the things that were going on in our area. So I talked with this gentleman, and he agreed to be my service sponsor. And so my recovery sponsor moves to California, and I'm in search for a recovery sponsor, and I cannot find a woman with more sobriety than me and somebody that I wanted something from. And I looked and I looked and I kept going to different meetings, and I would go to meetings where I thought there would be women with long-term sobriety, and I couldn't find people. I couldn't find a woman to, you know, with that. So he suggested that I create a want ad of a sponsor. Literally, you know, create the want ad. And so I do this, I get on the computer, graphics, everything, words, and I look at it, and you know what the answer is. My service sponsor was the person who I outlined as the sponsor that I wanted for my recovery. And at that point in my recovery, I was comfortable having a male sponsor. I was married at the time, and so I asked my husband, who's in the rooms, if he'd have a problem if I had a male sponsor, and he did not. And so, you know, I started on a journey with my sponsor. And so, you know, we were getting to know each other, and I'd call him up, and I'd rant and rave about something, and he'd direct me to the big book. He'd say, go read page 32, call me back. So I went and do that. I call him back. I'm like, wow, how'd you know that? That was just absolutely perfect. Next time it happens, goes to another page in the big book, knows exactly what I need. And I am just, like, baffled at people who know that type of stuff. So then this one time I call, and he gives me a page to read, and I call him back. I said, that was so far off, I don't know what you were thinking. He says, oh, I meant this page, and I read it, and I call him back, and I'm like, now that was better. So now I get comfortable enough to talk with my sponsor about, so how do you really know this stuff? Because I can't recall this stuff from memory. He says, you really want to know? And I said, yeah, I really want to know. He says, I don't know any of that stuff. I just give you a number between 1 and 164. Just goes to show that if you are open enough to what our literature says, that it will, you'll find the answer. So you guys can go do that with your sponsees. It does work. So the other thing, so back to in the last 2 years, you know, I've been struggling with my job. I've had a couple spiritual awakenings, like the fact that, wow, I finally got while I'm having problems with all these people at work. It's because I'm not practicing tradition one. I'm not practicing tradition one at work. And so I had to do some work to figure out what was our thing, what was our common thread that was unifying us at work. Practicing these principles in all our affairs. Recently, we've gone through some restructuring. Better words are 2 rounds of layoffs. Friends that I have worked with for 15, 20 years no longer work together with them. And it's been a really challenging environment to be in. And, you know, the conversation that I was having with my sponsor this weekend was, you know, trusting in the process. And I'm starting to embrace that, but it's a big one. It's a really big one for me on how to trust the process of all these things that are going on at work, and my feelings around them, and still moving forward. So I'm going to continue to pray about how do I trust the process. We talked about prayer and meditation, about not only having gratitude, but saying thank you. And, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, through that, there'll be some relief. The other thing that's gone on is that the end of last May, my husband got laid off from work. And he is now recently employed, which is wonderful. But there was 9 months of going through having somebody unemployed in the household, and dealing with the effects of financial insecurity. And I'm just going to play on a few of our spiritual principles. You know, learning that when I spend money, that it affects the relationship with my family. And that while I may be self-supporting through my own contributions, I also contribute to a family household. And so some of my spending choices might affect unity in my family. My thoughts about being angry about him losing his job can be considered punitive. Concept 12, warranty 5 and 6. Might not be so love and respectful under certain circumstances. And all of these spiritual principles have been really right in my face over the last 9 to 10 months about how am I practicing these at home. You know, all the stuff that's going on, it's not about me picking up a drink. I don't want to pick up a drink. That's the farthest thing from my mind. But what happens when I get angry? What happens when my behavior causes that ripple effect in my family? And those are the things that I need to look at. It's not about the fact that he's unemployed or had you know, lost his job. It's about how am I showing up? Am I helping or am I hindering? And there were times that I could be either one or the other. And when I'm practicing these principles, you know, there's that spiritual thing that happens that all of a sudden I become at peace. You know, it's not resisting everything that's going on. I'm going to wrap up. You know, I think it was Steve who was up here and talked about his dad passing away. He's a teacher. And on the board, on a piece of paper in the workshop that we had, he talked about mind, body, and spirit. And so, you know, as I was sitting in the workshops today, I was getting the mind in check and my spirit in check, but I needed to get out this afternoon for a run, so I needed to get my body in check. And so as I was out on my little jaunt this afternoon, I was trying to think of some of the things that anchor me to this program. You know, sometimes we have the slogans, you know, that really just kind of call to us and bring us back. And, you know, there was a couple of them. I've been carrying, you know, fondling this coin up here. My dad, when he was sober, he would always tell me to carry spare change. And that was his little signal to say, carry your coin with you. Because at the end of the day, if you're having a hard time, you can reach in and pick up your coin and be reminded of your sobriety. When I was at conference, there were some things that were going on in the room. And I remember looking at my watch on this given day, and it was 3:33. And at 3:33 that day in the room I was at conference, there was a peace and serenity that I had with what was going on in the room. And so anytime that I see 333 as a time or a check number or something like that, I remember that peace and serenity that I had at that very moment. And those are just little anchors for me that remind me of my recovery, of my service work, of the things that are going on. And I want to close with my favorite part of the big book. There's just a little section here. And it's in A Vision for You. It's on page 152, and it's around, if you count the lines, around line 21. But I'll read the first part of it. And it talks about, is there a sufficient substitute? And what they're talking about is for alcohol and alcoholism. And it says, yes, there is a substitute. And it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. And my favorite part, the most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus, we find the fellowship, and so will you. And I'm so grateful that you are here tonight to listen. Above everything else, you have kept me sober today, and I want to thank all of you for an awesome weekend. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Deb. That was quite inspiring. I'm really glad to finally hear you. I had asked her when I was alternate delegate and Keith was, her husband was the delegate of HMB, and she says, no, I can't come because Keith's having his delegate's day of sharing. So I said, Keith rotated out. Now you're available, so I'm asking you again. So it came around anyway. Thank you so much for coming and spending your time with us. That was lovely.